Hey, it's Dolla White, and this is the Dolla White Podcast. My guest today is Dr. James Hildreth, President and CEO of Meharry Medical College, world-renowned infectious disease expert, HIV researcher, and graduate of Oxford and Johns Hopkins Universities. Basically, he's way smarter than anyone most of us have personally spoken to about the pandemic, so feel free to play this for the dumbass in your life that refuses to wear a mask. Welcome to the Dolla White Podcast.
Pull up, Giddy. Live.
Yeah, what's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolla White Podcast.
All right. Welcome into episode 2 of the podcast. I am very excited to have my guest today, Dr. James Hildreth. He is the president and CEO of Meharry Medical College and also an infectious disease expert right here in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Hildreth, thank you for being on the podcast.
Bill White, thank you for having me. I'm really super excited to be here with you.
I guess we can start here because you're probably the most intelligent person I'm ever going to have on this podcast. And amongst our friends and everybody on the outside of the medical field, we all talk about when this thing is going to end. So I'm going to ask this question in a different way. Let's say you are a gambling man and you had the BetMGM app on your phone. When would you put your money down on when we're going to be free and clear of COVID-19?
Well, free and clear would mean that no mask wearing, economy is fully open, schools are fully open, et cetera. And quite honestly, the soonest that can happen would be this time next year.
Wow.
And I say that because there are 2 vaccines that are very likely to have emergency use authorization before this year is over, or early January at the latest. So that means vaccines become available to the general public starting early next year. But people need to understand we've got to figure out how to distribute and vaccinate 330 million people. That's never been done before. The logistical challenges are enormous. Plus, there's the vaccine hesitancy we've got to deal with among certain population groups. I think if I were to bet, it would be this time next year, if all goes well, we can all, you know, breathe a sigh of relief that this thing is behind us. I don't think it'd be any sooner than that.
I'm glad you touched on the hesitancy because, I mean, just on somebody that scrolls Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter constantly, there is a lot of hesitancy. And I honestly understand it, especially from African Americans because of past injustices. And I also understand it from the point that maybe some of these vaccines seem kind of rushed. What would you say to kind of ease people's minds on those?
So let's deal with the fact that the vaccine seems rushed first. There are 2 things that people should understand to explain why we've been able to go from January the 10th, when the virus's genome was published, to November the 10th, which is about 10 months, to having a vaccine ready to be presented to the FDA. There are 2 things to know. One is the technology available to vaccine scientists is nothing like it was just even a couple of years ago. To give you an example of what I mean by that is that the total genome for the virus SARS-CoV-2 was published in early January. And less than a month later, Dolla White, we had at least one vaccine candidate already identified. That process used to take years to achieve, a year at the minimum. So we compressed through technologies a process that used to take a year or more into less than a month. And that's technology that did that for us. The other thing is, there's a well-established infrastructure called the HIV Vaccine Trials Network that consists of academic health science centers all over the world, really, that are focused on developing an HIV vaccine. You got trained staff, you got trained scientists and investigators. They were asked to pause their HIV work and focus their attention on COVID-19. So there's enormous infrastructure that had been focused on HIV, paused, turned their attention to COVID-19, and that is why having the technology be what it is and having this pre-existing infrastructure allowed us to move very, very rapidly from a genome being published to having vaccines ready for FDA review in 10 months. And it's quite extraordinary. The hesitancy and mistrust that African Americans feel in particular is well justified because actually going all the way back to 1619, atrocities have been visited upon Black bodies in the service of medicine and research. And that's just a fact. The most prominent of those that people know most about, of course, is Tuskegee. But what people need to know about Tuskegee is that it was a horrible experiment visited upon 600 black men who were poor, mostly uneducated. It lasted for four decades, and it was so bad that the president of the United States, Bill Clinton, in 1997, apologized on behalf of the country to these men. That I don't think that had ever happened before. That's how bad it was. But as bad as it was, Tuskegee precipitated some profound changes in how research is done when humans are involved. We now have informed consent. We have institutional review boards. We have data safety monitoring boards. And there are so many levels now of review and transparency that this is nothing like Tuskegee. And I can assure those who are listening that it certainly is safe for us to participate in the studies. And we got to get the vaccine when it becomes available, because we need it more than any other group.
I'm glad you touched on that, because I also want to touch on trusting doctors as a whole. I feel like people, when they get sick, they go to the doctor. And if the doctor says, you've got an ear infection, here's some antibiotics, everybody goes home, takes them, and doesn't think twice about it. With this particular pandemic, it feels like some people aren't listening to the same people that they listen to when they actually get sick. And I don't understand for the life of me what's going on in the minds of some people.
Well, a perfect illustration of that starts at the very top of the leadership of our country. For months and months, our president bashed science, bashed the scientists who do the science, bashed the public health workers. But when he got COVID-19, the first thing he did was to accept the product of the work of the scientists very happily, and then extol the virtues of the science that made it possible for him to take these drugs. Now, whether or not the drugs worked as well as he professed them to, my point is there's a certain level of hypocrisy that really bothers me deeply that has been manifested in this whole thing. But you're absolutely right. Science is a part of all of our lives every day, and many things we take for granted is because science made it possible for us to take those things for granted. There are lots of examples. The fact that we can sit in an aluminum tube 6 miles in the sky, traveling 400 miles an hour, and trust that it's safe to do that. None of that would have been possible without science. Science made that possible. Safe food, medicines, communications. I mean, all of those things are the result of science. We take them for granted. But it seems that in a situation where science should be leading us, it's being dismissed by those who lead us. And that's unfortunate. But our approach to dealing with the mistrust and the apprehension is to identify trusted messengers, to have those conversations with people. And the people you named, the physicians, African-American minority physicians, are truly trusted messengers. And I'm so pleased to see that all over the country, Black health professionals have taken up the mantle of the challenge of convincing our people to be part of the studies, but also to take the vaccine. So I think we're going to get it done. It's going to be hard because, again, it's justified for us to be apprehensive based on the history we've lived through. But on the other hand, we need the vaccine more than any other group. So we got to get this done. And we will.
What would have been the right approach to take from day one of this pandemic? Are we still here if the right measures were taken, you know, in January or December of last year?
What I said on my Twitter feed in early parts of this challenge, when it became known, explicitly known, that the risk of the virus was not shared equally across the population, then that means that a population approach is not what you do. And a population approach means that we assume that everybody has the same risk. So we take the same measures for everybody. But Delaware, clearly the risk is not the same across the populations in the United States, i.e. Black folks and brown folks are clearly at much higher risk than the majority population. So the focus should have been on testing, contact tracing, and all those things should have been a major push for us in our communities. And that's why I asked the House Ways and Means Committee for $5 billion to allow the four Black medical schools to set up an infrastructure to achieve that. Because the risk is not equal for the people who live in this country. Every nursing home and assisted living facility back in March should have been screened for COVID-19. Because as you know, quite a number of the deaths that we've seen have been in those facilities. Because once the virus breaks out in those facilities where people are living in close quarters, poor ventilation and poor mobility of the inhabitants or residents there, it's a nightmare waiting to happen, and we've seen it manifested over and over again. So back in March and certainly by mid-April, we should have been testing every facility in the country for COVID-19 to identify where the virus is and take steps to fix it. And the other thing is, all of us should have been wearing masks from the very beginning, but why couldn't we do that? We couldn't because there was a shortage of masks. Imagine, we live in a country where we spend $3.5 trillion, not billion, $1 trillion on healthcare, and we're scrambling to find masks and swabs. It's just unbelievable. But the reason for that, not doing those things, is because we had to save those things for the healthcare workers. But the bottom line is, all of us should have been wearing masks. There should have been a more focused approach for the most vulnerable, and we could have saved many, many tens of thousands of lives if we had done that.
Let's talk about masks for a second, because I honestly don't understand what the drawback is from a mask. I wear one every time I, you know, walk out of the house to go grocery shopping or whatever it is I'm doing. It doesn't bother me. It literally doesn't make my life, you know, any worse at all. Yes. But I see people saying, oh, it's going to limit your oxygen. I see all kinds of craziness that I'm just like, doctors and nurses have been wearing these things for Absolutely. The entirety of medicine, and you right. know, everybody's fine. So right. can we just talk about masks for a minute and why it's so important that there really probably are no drawbacks?
There are none that I'm aware of. I mean, there are some people who legitimately might be, you know, encumbered by them because they have, you know, breathing conditions. They have to, you know, have devices and all that. But the point you made is one that I made over and over again. The healthcare workers who are on the front line of the COVID-19 fight, they're wearing masks 12, 14, 16 hours a day on our behalf. They're putting their lives at risk on our behalf. And almost 2,000 of them have died on our behalf fighting COVID-19. So I get really, really upset when people tell me that wearing a mask is inconvenient. They don't want to do it. And for some of them, of course, it's making a political statement. They're just following in the wake of the president, who, as you say, has minimized this whole thing from the very beginning. And what people need to understand is that some appear to think that they wear a mask to protect others, right? And they don't want to do it because they don't feel it's their responsibility to protect others. Some people actually told me that. But people listening need to know that masks work in both directions. If you're not infected with COVID-19 and you wear a mask, you lower the risk dramatically that you'll get infected. So you are being protected from the virus in the same way that if you're infected, you keep it from being transmitted to others. So the fact that it works in both directions means that no matter who's infected with the virus, if all of us are wearing masks, we can slow down the transmission and speed up the time when the virus is eliminated from our community. So mask wearing has been shown over and over again to profoundly and dramatically reduce the risk and spread of the virus. So all of us should be doing it. And as far as we know, there are no threats to health or wellness by doing so.
One thing that I always tell people is in 2012, my best friend and my partner on the radio, Scoob, passed away of a disease called sarcoidosis that he did not know he had. And I always think of him when it comes to who's most vulnerable to get the most sick from this disease, because if he were alive today and still didn't know he had sarcoidosis, he would be very vulnerable to this disease. Right. And there are certain things that no matter how good your healthcare is, you don't get tested for every year. He had just had a physical and did not know he had sarcoidosis. That could be any of us.
That's right.
And I just think it's not a good game to play if you're not taking those precautions.
It's not, because it's true that for the most part, the younger you are, perhaps the less risk you have of getting sick from COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, the virus. And the older you are, the risk goes up that you will get sick or really sick. But we know of 2-year-olds who've died from it, 8-year-olds. There are people in their 30s and 40s who have cardiac challenges because of the infection. You know, people in their 40s and 50s who are really healthy have died of strokes from COVID-19. So since we don't know who these individuals are and we can't predict who they are, the wisest thing to do for all of us is to take the steps needed to protect ourselves. And oh, by the way, by doing that, we're actually helping the whole community because we lower the risk of the virus spreading. So your point is well taken, that sometimes people can appear to be perfectly healthy, but there are conditions that have silent effects in our bodies. It's not apparent that they're even happening to us. And it takes something like a COVID-19 pandemic to reveal just how challenging some of these things can be. So your point is very well taken.
If we in America had universal health care like, you know, Canada and countries in Europe, do you think we'd be in better shape to fight something like that? Or would it not make much of a difference?
I think it would make a difference from this perspective, that in those places, there is a focus placed on preventative medicine, and public health is practiced more routinely than it is here. By that, I mean that nutrition, exercise, physical activity, all of those things are emphasized. So, for example, obesity tends to be much less frequent in those places. And of course, obesity is a profoundly important risk factor for COVID-19. Many people who are obese, regardless of their age, when they get COVID-19, they don't do very well at all. So if we had universal health care in this country that placed an emphasis on preventative health measures and focused on childhood health, that would change everything, because a lot of the things that we deal with in terms of chronic conditions, there are things we can do at the level of children that would nip those things in the bud, diabetes being one of them, prominent among those things, that would change the profile of what we've seen here in our country for COVID-19. Because heart disease, asthma, obesity, high blood pressure, all those things have led to excess death from COVID-19 among minorities. And I think having universal health care and having access to the things that healthcare can offer would have made a big difference. So yes, I do think it would have made a big difference.
I've heard a lot about, you know, treatments and drugs and vaccines. Do you feel like people have pushed out enough natural ways to maybe boost your immune system a little bit? Because I don't hear much talk about that, but I would think that would help. And I've heard vitamin D can help. I've heard, you know, different things that just boost your natural immune system. I don't hear them well advertised, though.
Maybe there's not been enough emphasis placed on it, but you're right. The best way to keep your immune system healthy is through a healthy diet. It's really that simple. And a healthy diet means that those rare metals and trace elements and vitamins that we need for some of the processes that the immune system and other systems need. And there is evidence now that vitamin D deficiency can contribute to worse outcomes for COVID-19. The bottom line is one's overall health, including your nutrition status, plays a really big role. And again, that's why African Americans have done rather poorly with COVID-19, because our overall health status is not where it needs to be. And so I'm hoping that one of the lessons that will come out of this, not just for us to understand it ourselves, but for the whole country to understand, that there's a profound gap in the health status in our country, and our economy, overall health of the country, and all those things demand that we pay attention to it and we find solutions for it.
And I think we definitely have to start listening to the people that do it every day, people like you, because you actually know what you're talking about. And I'm not going after, you know, Fox News in general, but I honestly feel like they have some blood on their hands with this, because when you put out false messages and when you deny science and the same people that you go to when you get sick, when you tell the general public that they don't know what they're talking about, and then people die as a result of that, some of that blood is on your hands.
I totally agree that history is not going to look kindly upon some of the players in this, including, unfortunately, well, there's no getting around the fact that Fox News, that Fox Network has promulgated some ideas that are actually dangerous, because they offer a picture of this pandemic, the virus and its danger, that's really not matched to reality. That when people rely on that network for their information, and some of these people know what they're saying to be incorrect. And to me, that's the part that bothers me the most, to knowingly push out false narratives that you know can do harm. It's hard to understand how that could be acceptable. But that's what we're witnessing here in the country right now.
I agree. And it's really sad. Is there any other messages that you want to get out before I ask you my last and final question, which is a very selfish question of mine? But are there any other messages we need to get out? Because I know you've got a lot going on right now.
I do want people to know that Thanksgiving is going to be a pivotal moment for us, pivotal day, pivotal period, because right now we're approaching 200,000 new cases per day and 2,000 deaths per day. And people need to know that for every case we diagnose through a PCR test for COVID-19, there are probably several that do not get diagnosed, which means there are a lot of people out there transmitting the virus without knowing that they are. So out of an abundance of caution, to make sure that some of the seats at the table are not empty next Thanksgiving, I strongly urge people to celebrate virtually and not put older relatives or people with chronic conditions in danger by gathering together this Thanksgiving. I'm just strongly urging people to do that so that next Thanksgiving, all the chairs can be filled. Because if we do what we are planning to do on Thanksgiving, it may well be that we're going to some funerals virtually in January. None of us want that. So I would just say to people listening, please, please know that there's a lot of virus out there. And if at all possible, we strongly urge you not to travel and to celebrate virtually to protect the people that you love.
I 100% stand by you in that sentiment. My family, we haven't even gone and sat inside of a restaurant since March. I mean, we've gone and picked up and then sat in the park or, you know, something like that. But we haven't even gone to a restaurant since March. We miss it. You know, I miss going on dates with my wife, but
yep.
This is where we are and you accept it.
Same here.
Yeah. So my final question is this. My wife and I like to travel. Obviously, we haven't traveled at all this year. I know you said next year we're free and clear. But when would you say we'd be clear to jump on a plane? Same time next year or maybe a little bit before that?
I think some airlines have done a good job of providing for safe travel in terms of spacing people out and all this. But clearly, by spring of next year, not the fall of next year, I think that travel itself would be a lot safer. I can't emphasize how important these next 60 days will be between now, November the 20th and December, January 20th, when the changeover happens. We got 60 days that if we don't get on top of this thing, I mean, there's still like 300 and what, 20 million people out there who can still get infected, which means that this virus has a lot of damage it can still do. So it's really important we get on top of it now that we're in the winter, fall, winter, when people are inside. But I'm thinking that from my own perspective, next spring will probably be a time to think about getting. I haven't been on a plane since March the 4th, and nothing anybody could say right now would convince me to get on a plane unless it's a family emergency. I'm just not going to do it. But I think that by next spring, if we handle things appropriately now, between now and then, with the vaccine coming online in January, February, I will consider flying again in late April, May. That's my.
Well, I'm not getting on a plane until you do, Dr. Hildreth. I'll say that. So I'm gonna follow your lead. If I
right now, like I said, unless it's a family emergency, and it's not worth it. It's not worth the risk.
No, I get it. We're right there with you. Thank you so much for doing this podcast and for being on the radio. And check back in if there are other messages you need to get out. This is only episode 2 of my podcast, and it's completely feasible that I just tapped out the intelligence level. You might be the most intelligent guest that I ever have. No matter how long this thing goes. So
very kind. I appreciate it. And keep up the good work.
Hey, thank you, sir.
All right. Take care. Bye.
All right. I want to say thank you once again to my guest, Dr. James Hildreth, for being on the podcast today. And thank you for checking this out and listening. Make sure that you subscribe regardless of the platform that you're listening on. And also follow me, Instagram and Twitter, @DoleWite101, DoleWite101. I'm out.